Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by Rob Stringer, Chief Executive of Sony Music Entertainment. During his 30-year career, he's worked with some of the top names in music, including The Clash, George Michael, Bruce Springsteen and David Bowie. Most recently, he helped launch Harry Styles' solo career and oversaw the release of Adele's 25 and Beyoncé's Lemonade. Prior to joining Sony in 2001, he led both CBS and Epic Records and will shortly receive the Music Industry Trusts Award for his outstanding contribution to the industry. Rob, thank you for joining me.
Nice to be here.
So, Rob, before we started the recording, we were making a bit of chit-chat, and as you know, I live in Buckinghamshire. You're from Aylesbury originally. How does a teenage punk fan from Aylesbury become one of the biggest players in the global entertainment industry?
That teenage punk fan was from some article in about 2000. No, actually, from 1994. And I'm forever... ever cast as a teenage punk fan.
You don't look like a punk rocker now.
No, well, it's 40 years later. But, I mean, no, I come from Aylesbury, which was then, back in the 70s, was a market town. And I think, honestly, the whole reason that I got into music after my, you know, sort of younger years listening to Radio 1 and listening to, you know, kids' television was that we had an independent record shop in Aylesbury. And we had a club which basically ran every Saturday night, run by the promoter who also owned the independent record shop. And they put every great band ever in the country.
Name's anyone who was there.
Oh, I mean, literally. I mean, it was a mile from my house. And in 76 and 77, I saw Blondie, the Ramones, the Clash, the Talking Heads, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, the Jam. Before I was old enough to go, and I did get turned away, first of all, when I was 14 because I was too young. That was to go and see the Stranglers and the Vibrators. And I didn't get into that, but then I got in with a dodgy membership card to see Eddie and the Hot Rods about a month later. But basically, before that, David Bowie had played there six times. He played Ziggy Stardust for the first time ever at Aylesbury. So for whatever reason, this small market town had this one guy.
Was it the hotbed of the music scene?
Yeah, it was. And they had this one guy who was a focus point for the music of the musical sort of education of a whole town. And so therefore, I don't think it's coincidental that so many people in the music business come from Aylesbury. And also my chemistry teacher at school, at grammar school, was the guy who ran the door. So he employed us all to work when we got to be sort of 17-ish. We all worked at the club. So for whatever reason, again, I mean, you know, I was rubbish at chemistry. I mean, so I didn't learn anything from chemistry. But luckily, this guy got me to work at a rock club. And that was one of the first, you know, experiences of working within music. It was a mile from my house.
And did you decide at that point, I want a career in music?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, without sounding like a precocious brat, I mean, I was reading The Enemy and Melody Maker when I was 8 years old. I knew that's what I wanted to do. I mean, I've talked before about, you know, starting with Junior Choice and listening to every record on Junior Choice and listening to Radio Luxembourg on a transistor radio under my pillows, realizing I had no musical talent whatsoever, really. And then literally, you know, from then on in, I've just soaked everything up like a sponge. So I knew I wanted to do it. I didn't really have any clue how I was going to do it, but I knew that's what I wanted to do. So
you just said then yourself you had no musical talent. So did you know you would be an industry figure, that you'd be an exec?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was in sort of rubbishy bands when I was 14 and 15, which was sort of practicing someone else's garage. But yeah, I mean, I you know, I didn't perceive I was going to be exec. I mean, the next step after being in Aylesbury was that I went to Goldsmiths College, which is an arts college in southeast London. I did my degree and I became social secretary there, which meant I booked all the bands and organised all the parties and all the events. And that was a route into the music industry, particularly in the 70s. Less so once Margaret Thatcher got into power and cut all the student union funding. But I was probably the last years of that in 84, 85. So the route in was to be a booking agent. But I put bands on for 15 months and I'd done that job. And then I saw an advert in a student union newspaper that said, wanted graduates with experience in university entertainment. And that was basically me with anything else qualified for. But basically that advert was like Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory. It was like a gold
ray. The golden ticket.
Yeah, it was like a gold ray lifting from this student union newspaper, and
who was the advertiser?
CBS Records. And I was honestly, without, it wasn't being arrogant, I knew that was, I was going to get that job. I knew that I was qualified to do that because it just said exactly what I was qualified, despite the fact I wasn't qualified for anything else. I was qualified for that, and I knew I was going to get that job. And once I saw that, I mean, it was exciting, and I went for two interviews, and I started at CBS Records in 85 as a graduate trainee. Not that that meant anything, because I don't think they figured out what I was going to do, really. But it was...
What did you end up doing?
I ended up sitting at my friend Jackie's desk, and she's still in the company 35 years later, and so am I. So I sat at the end of her desk, and after about a month, they sort of said... you'll do. You can be a market assistant. And so that's how I started. And that was, as I said, 32, 33 years ago now. So,
what was the next rung up on the ladder?
Well, in those days, the record industry was really still growing. You know, I mean, it was between vinyl and cassettes and CDs. So there was a lot of record companies. So there was a lot of fluid movement. And I just moved up. I went from being an assistant to what was called a product manager, which did the marketing for bands. And then I started to work with bands and have my own projects that I worked with. And then I did that for about 4 years. And then I decided to move into A&R because I wanted to be much closer to the music. So I made that decision when I was like 28, 27, 28. And then
A&R stands for Artists and Repertoire, doesn't it? You see, I know that. Cool. But what does the job
involve? It's a very ancient terminology. I think it's a terminology back to the Beatles in 1963 or something.
I know what A&R does, obviously, but just for our listeners who don't have a clue.
Well, A&R would be...
I'm hoping they believe me.
A&R would be basically looking after the recording output and development of artists. So the
front line, you are the guys actually dealing with the artists.
So that's why I wanted to move from the marketing job I'd done for about 4 years. I wanted to move because I thought that was the closest to being exactly as you said on the front line, you know, and it was on the front line. It's, you know, being an A&R man, you know, has as many cliches as you'd expect. It is lonely and it's schizophrenic and it's slightly odd and it's slightly egotistical and you're insecure and all that, but you are the one that's closest to the music, and I wanted to take that gamble, and I'm very glad I did it because it taught me the most, what I think is the most difficult job in a record company. And you know, it's the most rewarded job, but it's also the most difficult, you know, because it's singular. It's like being a golfer or a tennis player, and that you can't blame anybody else. If the act doesn't work, then everybody blames you, you know. So it's not as much of a team sport player as some of the other roles in a record label.
And who did you work with? Are you able to name names? You know, was it a bit like Never Meet Your Heroes because you always have one a joy to work with?
No, I mean, you know, there's some people who are easier to work than others, but it wasn't. Most people were pretty good. I mean, I moved into A&R at Columbia, which was the label, and we changed from being CBS to Columbia, and I worked with, at that time, I worked with Alison Moyet and Paul Young and Deacon Blue, and I signed, the first band I signed, which was lucky, was the Manic Street Preachers. So they were the band that really I bonded with the closest, and actually 27 years later, we're still extremely close. So you know, I worked with an array of things, and it was a bit being chucked in the deep end because obviously a couple of those artists were huge global artists, you know, and so I learned quickly, or I failed quickly, and as I said, the results are quite public because everyone has an opinion of a record, you know. It's like, it doesn't matter whether it's your family or your friends or someone in the enemy or someone on the radio. People have got opinions. So you know, it was going in the deep end, but it was the right thing for me to do, I think.
Can you detach the artists themselves personally when you know them from their music? Because, I mean, you mentioned Alison Moyet. I'd listened to one of her tracks, All Cried Out. She was on my playlist in the car on the way to the station this morning. Yeah. If you actually know Alison Moyet personally, does that add to your enjoyment of her music, or does it slightly detract from it?
No, it doesn't. I don't think it detracts. I just think you listen to it in a different way. I mean, you know, obviously, artists, that's what they do, and you have to be very cognizant of the fact that that is their whole life. And so therefore you have to be incredibly sensitive and realize what you are dealing with. And it's incredibly difficult. My admiration as I've got older has got greater and greater for that process because artists are putting themselves on the line every day and it's them, you know. There's no, you're not hiding behind a character, or you haven't got a necessarily, you know, you can't use your team or you can't use anybody else to shield behind. You are absolutely out front, you know, and you have to justify yourself constantly. So you know, I learned that, and you know, some of the artists that that I've worked with over the years, I've become extremely friendly with. But I'm also aware of the artistic boundaries, and also aware where you don't cross the line.
Like what? What is the line in terms of getting too personal?
Well, I don't think it's being personal. It's just understanding what someone needs, because it's their life and their career. And you can't be as flippant as you could be, you know, with someone when you're dealing with someone, a mate down the pub who's just joking about what they did in the day. You've got to be very careful because you know, as I said, it's that everything that happens to an artist is sort of magnified somewhere. You know, I mean, it's like everything is larger than life, and that's hard to balance. And I have huge respect for the people who have managed to balance that equation out for 10, 20, 30, 40. I mean, we've got artists on our record label who've been signed to the company for 55 years, you know. Incredible. So I've got huge admiration for that ability to make that balance work for them.
Because not only, I imagine, are you incredibly vulnerable if you're kind of standing on the stage singing your heart out to a song you've written, but also it's quite precarious as well, isn't it, in terms of, you know, history's littered with bands who've had two or three good albums and then the label drops them and then they're still going after all these years in obscurity, because success itself at that level is very, very tenuous.
Yeah, it's brutal. And as the word you use, vulnerability, is part of the reason why artists get known in the first place, because they put their artistic vulnerability into words and music, and then the public hears it. So, yeah, I mean, as I said, as I've got older, my respect grows more for that process. And I've had those conversations with many, you know, artists that are famous and many artists that actually didn't work. And I understand that vulnerability even more in hindsight, because, you know, I've had artists that I've worked with who had tremendous success and didn't enjoy it at the time. And I would go back to them. And at the time, I might say to them, you know, you really should enjoy this. It probably doesn't get any better than this. And the reason the art was as good as it was because they weren't enjoying it. It's a bit like the sort of Vincent van Gogh painting in an attic. You know, it's like, you know, those records weren't from enjoyment. They weren't from a party that they loved. They were from pain. And so that process I am incredibly cognizant of when I'm dealing with artists. You know, and listen, I mean, it is a very precarious career. I mean, you know, if you have several hits, you probably have a long term career, particularly as the whole business gets more mature. And you know, there are nostalgia is actually a big part of the music business now.
I was in Pasadena a few weeks ago and I went to see Tony Hadley.
And
to be honest, he was brilliant.
Yeah, I worked with Spandau Ballet on Through the Barricades and the Red Heart Like a Sky, the album after that. And I keep in touch with most of them as well. And
I'm not sure they're keeping in touch with each
they're
other.
They're not keeping, which
unless
is
their lawyers.
Which is really sad. Which is really sad because, you know, I mean, the fact that when they got back together and they did those shows, they were definitely better than they'd ever been. But you know, I mean, again, it's very difficult. And like, well, Tony's doing good, I think. He does make money. And,
you know what?
And he deserves to. Because first of all, you know, him and, you know, and the band, and obviously with Gary being the songwriter, I mean, they wrote a lot of good records. They had a lot of hits. So I'm really glad that there's careers for those. I think it's great. I mean, the most heartwarming stories are always somebody that wrote a song 35 years ago, someone covers it, and they make millions of dollars because the publishing pays and someone hears a song in a completely different way. And those are the best stories we have, you know. But yes, I mean, the good news is if you have several hits, you can have a career. One hit, more difficult, you know. And as we both know, the record business and chart history is loaded with one hit wonders. You know, sometimes they had one idea, sometimes they had one song. You know, I mean, that's frequent too.
I don't know why Kung Fu Fighting's popped into mind, but that to me is the ultimate one hit wonder.
I think he had a second one though, and I'm really train spotty about songs, really. And I could, there was definitely a second top 10 hit from Carl Douglas.
I'm going to be singing that.
You're
Kung
too
Fu
young
Fighting.
To remember Carl
no,
Douglas.
I'm absolutely not.
Really?
No, I use Oil of Yule quite extensively, and I've aged well.
I remember, Kung Fu Fighting was. I mean, that was a, like a production team, a guy called Bidu, who worked on those records, and he also did the Tina Charles record, I Love to Love. So
the best feedback I get on Twitter about this podcast is when I introduce obscure references. I did a Back to the Future 2 reference a couple of weeks ago, and I got a few tweets from that.
Let's go for it.
Absolutely.
Let's go. Listen, we can do the whole podcast about one-hit wonders.
let's do it.
And I can probably give you several facts back, and we can have fun.
Let's do a separate one-hit wonder podcast. You heard it here first, people.
I'm up for it. Yeah, I mean, I unfortunately, from a very young age, the detail fascinated me. So you can put a Pilot record on, and you know, I can name it in 3 bars. You know, so
do you think we commoditize artists too much as a society? Like, for example, there we mentioned Tony Hadley. I saw him live. As I was going to the gig, Now I'm thinking about him as a person, about as an artist, because you've reframed how I'm thinking about him. But when I was on my way there in the Uber, I thought, I hope he does all the Spandau hits, a couple of modern ones, and maybe one or two token songs that he's written that he wants us to hear. And I thought, I hope he doesn't do like 3 Spandau Ballet hits and then 10 of his latest stuff, because I thought, I'm not interested in that. And it was interesting. My thought process there wasn't about him as an artist, as a person. It was about me selfishly just wanting to hear what I wanted to hear, as if he was some human jukebox. So I'm guilty of this myself. Do we commoditize artists? I think he might have stage fright, but I didn't even think about that. I thought, when's he going to do Gold?
Yeah, well, I think that's a natural human reaction, really. I mean, there's a really great sketch on that show, Big Train, that Simon Pegg did, where Ralph McTell's doing Streets of London, and then he introduces another song, and he goes, it's about fishermen in Cornwall or something, and the whole audience, a guy drops his pint, and just people start saying, Streets of London? No, Streets of London, and he just done it, you know, and then he's trying to do this song about fishermen in Cornwall, and he goes straight back into Streets of London, and people cheer, you know, thank God he's going back to doing Streets of London, despite the fact he just did it. No, I mean, yes, the it's a human reaction to want to hear the things they want to hear, because people have songs, and they have memories, and they remember when they got married, they remember they met their boyfriend, their girlfriend, they remember the time they were driving down a street and they heard the record the first time. So I understand that. I mean, artists understand that parameter. Some artists don't necessarily adhere to that. I mean, Bob Dylan, who's one of our greatest artists of all time, and it's really, you know, Picasso, really. You know, the set list isn't dependent on being a human jukebox at all. You know, it's like, I think he plays what he wants to play, and I think for the most part, his audience goes with him.
Well, they have no choice,
but he's a legend, you know, but they go with him.
Turn up to collect his Nobel Prize.
I think he went and said hello to the people eventually, though. So it's like, you know, you can
that's,
say...
That's the level you want to be at.
You can
though,
say nothing. I mean, I went to see Girl from the North Country last night, the Old Vic, which is a play with his music, a musical with his music interpreted. It was spectacular. I mean, obviously that he's a different level, but for the most part, I think that it's a balance artists have to make. You know, it's like I went to see, we have Depeche Mode signed to us, and Depeche Mode the other night played Madison Square Garden. And they did 5 or 6 songs off the new record in the first half of the set. Second half of the set was mostly hits. But the first half of the set, their attitude, I think, probably is they're going to go on the road for a year and play this show in arenas and stadiums around the world. They want to play new songs. And I completely concur with that. You know, but the second half of the show was was hits galore, and it was great. So
how did you move from A&R into becoming a kind of... Are you a suit now? What would you describe yourself as? Tell us, let's carry on the journey.
The phrase suit. I know, that's another cliche record label.
Deliberately provocative.
I know, you're just
welcome to the
jamming,
cliche
you're
podcast.
Just jamming me. You're just jamming me.
A series
me.
Of one-to-one cliches with CEOs at the top of the music game.
Yeah, I'm wearing a trilby in a 3-piece suit here. No, I mean, that's fine. I mean, listen, all the cliches about, you know, the Spinal Tap like references to record labels, a lot of them are true. You know, not all of them. I mean, I get people saying to me all the time, what we'd like to do is we'd like to come into your label for a day and do a documentary. And I'm like, I bet you would. Because then they take all the normal, mundane, detailed, diligent, disciplined bits of what we do, and then they put the daft bits in, and then we'd have, you know, a record label that looked like a sketch show, you know. So, you know, I mean, you know, look, I mean, I'm an exec now, but I'm trying to instill the principles and the foundation of the right thing to do into the people who work for me.
Love of music. You've got to sell it. You're a business, but on the other hand, it's got to be done from a place of passion.
It has to be done from a place of passion, a place of purity, and a place of understanding the artist's difficulties in doing what they do. And that's very important to me. And, you know, hopefully maintaining a relationship with the art still, because if I didn't maintain a relationship with the art, then I don't think I'd be very happy, really. I think I'd be a bit miserable. You know, so.
What makes a great artist? Do you know? Is, again, this might be a cliche, but this is one where I'm not deliberately doing it. Is, can you listen to a record and think that's going to be a hit, even if you don't like it or not? Can you disconnect from your own subjective analysis and say, well, I'm not a One Direction guy, but he's going to be big?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think What Makes You Beautiful was a great record, you know. It's like, so when that was the first single from One Direction, you go, okay, well, that's just a great record. I remember hearing that. I mean, I knew all about the record and we had it and everything, but I remember hearing that in America in some, like 2 months before it came out in America, I remember hearing it in some trendy shop somewhere, and I thought, that just sounds great. You know, that sounds like a proper timeless pop record. So yeah, I mean, you know, I can detach myself, you know. I mean, you can't like everything. I mean, it's like, that's impossible. It's for human taste. You can't like every single record you ever hear, but I'm able to distinguish between what's good and what's not, hopefully, and what and hopefully, although you get it wrong, quite honestly, more times you get it right, what's a hit and what's not. And that's not easy to do, and as I said, you can get that, you know, that the strike rate on that isn't, you know, 80%. The strike rate on that's probably, if you're lucky, 20%. You know?
I mean, the music industry has changed so much. I can remember when I was a kid listening to the chart show, Top 40, Mark Goodyear and even Bruno Brooks counting down, and with my thumb hovering over the pause button on the tape so that I could, as soon as Bruno stopped speaking, and I wish he just shut up, so that I could just get the whole song.
You could play the whole record. Yeah,
exactly. But I mean, nowadays it's all Spotify playlists. I mean, for example, I listen to Six Music. They have a Six Music playlist on Spotify where it's exactly the same what they're about to play for the next couple of hours, but without the guy talking in the middle.
Yeah.
And I've got a choice of, well, it's the same curation, but do I want a DJ in the middle of it or not?
Yeah, well, I think it depends if you like the DJ, doesn't it? I mean, some of the radio stuff is okay. You know, I mean, it's like, I like some DJs enormously, and there's some DJs, particularly on pop radio, that I would turn down in the car in between, never mind taping it. I would turn it down in the car and turn it back up, much to my teenage daughter's distraction. I said, I'm sorry, I just cannot listen to that DJ. He's been to the whatever boarding school they go for blandness on radio talking, you know. So, yeah, I mean, I, you know, listen, I don't think that's changed that much. I think the playlist you looked at on Spotify is replacing the chart rundown you'd have listened to when you were a kid growing up. It's the same, you know, and people take the playlist very seriously on streaming platforms. I mean, those playlists are people's soundtrack, almost like the charts used to be our soundtrack. And the charts do matter. I mean, you know, believe it or not, the positioning you have in those playlists is extremely important in terms of getting people's attention span. You know, Apple's iTunes still has a chart that it's good to be in the top 10 of. And I don't think people take the charts as seriously. I mean, you know, I was literally... The charts used to run on a Tuesday, because I'm that old.
They did, and, in the morning, didn't they? Mike Smith used to count
them down. Well, sort of, I think it was like 12 o'clock or something. And we used to stand in the playground at school, and someone, not me, because I wasn't the funkiest person there, would have a transistor radio, and we would listen to the rundown in the playground, and it was that exciting.
I remember it being that exciting. Yeah, now no one cares.
Yeah, I mean, I think a number one song, single particularly, has tangibility. I still think that matters. And it, by the way, it matters to artists. Even I'm of the frame of mind sometimes going, well, yeah, it's going to be number one, particularly with albums. It's going to be number one, but it will be number 11 next week. They still want the number one album. So the number one single does mean something still. I mean, you know, it does
mean... Or you get to, like, the level of Ed Sheeran, where it's not just that he's number one, he's got 38 places of the entire top 40.
Yeah, but I think he takes that very seriously, Ed Sheeran. I mean, I think he's competitive, and I think he looks at those charts, and that does matter to him. It certainly matters to some artists. I mean, Taylor Swift, it definitely matters to, you know. So that, you know, that scale of detail is important to a lot of artists, yeah.
As the nature of what a record company does... Has that changed over the years, given the internet? So, for example, I mean, if you're to believe sort of Justin Bieber's origin story, it's that he was discovered on YouTube and blah, blah, blah. That used to be part of what a record company do, is that you'd have people at local gigs discovering artists, you'd sign them up and you'd make the millions.
Yeah, I mean, it's always the way artists are signed, some of them extremely conventional still, and it could be 1958, it could be that, you know, it's like, and then some, there's a much more modernistic way of signing them. I mean, look, we've had to adapt the way we do things. We had an element of control when the business was first starting, probably all the way through and to the last chapters of the CD era. We were in control. We're not so much in control now. I mean, you know, distribution isn't controlled by us. We used to make plastic discs and put them in plastic cases and send them off from our factories and distribution plants to record stores. So we controlled the process. We don't control the process now. The internet and, you know, post Napster and downloading and then streaming, we don't control that. You know, I'm not uncomfortable with that process. I actually like the fact that to be in charge can lead to misuse of that power, and so for it to be a bit more egalitarian is a good thing. And as a result, the way we discover artists is very different. And some of that information, streaming and doubt, we have a tremendous amount of data information now. So we can tell very quickly for records. We can tell if a record's happening in a small town. We can tell if a record's happening because of a Spotify or Apple playlist. We have a huge amount of data. So the way we look at what's happening or not is very different to what might have happened even 5 years ago, never mind 50 years ago. So,
but can you still make the big bucks now? Because there's, I mean, you can actually self-publish to Spotify now, and I could film my own video on me on the guitar and stick it straight on YouTube and collect the royalties myself.
You could, and
I mean, obviously, I'd be terrible.
No. I hope you make millions with your with your guitar playing on YouTube. You know, please do. but the ability to do that is there. Having said that, it's incredibly crowded. And you know, we used to run a kind of passport control, and everybody would go, you've got to send a demo tape into a record label, and that is not as prevalent now. But the fact is that there are a lot of people on the internet. It's crowded. So to be seen and heard on YouTube is not easy. You know, you've still got to have something that's either, quite honestly, completely novelty-based, or it's got to be really good. You know, so I mean, it hasn't... I don't think it's become easier to get signed to a record label. Now, the monetary system is different, and again, we just had to get used to that. You know, we don't control all the finance anymore, and people can make money doing themselves and everything. You know, I'm not sure that if you want to be a genuine global artist, that is harder to do that without people helping you and having a support system and an international system with a lot of people all around the world facing the same direction. I still believe in that, and I think that that's still important, because even though the internet covers the world and makes the world a smaller place, that every market is different. You know, Spotify's big in some markets, Apple's bigger in others, some radio stations are more important in certain markets. You know, the way that music is consumed is extremely different in France to the way it is in America. In France, you can work a record for 28 weeks to get it to number one, and in the UK, it's 3 weeks. So there are a lot of vagaries of the difference. And obviously, we have a huge experience of those differences. And also, we hope that we can lend experience and expertise to the process. And we have to rely much more on that expertise and experience now, because it's much more of an open playing field.
Well, you mentioned Deacon Blue earlier on in the podcast. I mean, I bought Dignity on cassette single and paid $3.49 for it at Woolworths.
$3.49? It wasn't that much, was it?
Oh, yeah, it was. Cassette singles were quite expensive in the day. You know, let's say it's a quid for the cassette, yeah, and
very
the distribution.
Posh
Will
words, that, Paul.
Well, it was from York.
Was it Knightsbridge or something?
No, it was in Coley Street in York.
Excellent.
But I imagine, you know, there's a quid to Woolworths, a quid for the production of the cassette single, and you're left with £1.49. I imagine you give 50p to Ricky Ross and his ilk, and then you get a quid or whatever. But with Spotify, what do you get? Like 0.1 pence per player?
The equation's complicated. But
is it because millions more people are paying that 0.1 pence?
Yeah, exactly. So you know, we've got our artists who on a song have done a billion streams. You know, so
a billion 0.1s is obviously a lot.
Yeah, it adds up.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But I mean, you know, the economics of the 7-inch single in the 70s with you selling 2 million singles at whatever it was, you know, 50p a single, you know, were pretty dramatic, the economics. And the royalty systems and the deals that artists had would seem prehistoric now compared to what artists get paid now. So it's very different. And obviously artists' rights and, you know, the lawyers and the legal community have obviously wised up in 50 years. And so I'm very grateful. You know, we don't rip artists off the way we did probably in the 60s when the business was all brand new and people were figuring out the payments. I mean, there's lots of stories. I mean, whatever the Beatles merchandising was sold for was probably 10% or something, and now it would be 90%. I mean, you know, everyone was learning at the time, and it was entrepreneurs who were developing these systems and rights systems, and they've changed dramatically over 50 years. So you know, the idea hopefully isn't to rip anybody off these days. So that's not my intention anyway. But the metrics are very different. The metrics are very different from a 7-inch single where you sold 2 million copies to a billion streams. They're different measurements.
And the nature of what artists do to get revenue now has changed, has it not? Because there's me on my way in the Uber in Pasadena to see Tony Hadley. I listen to, five tracks and he gets 0.3 pence or whatever. Mm-hmm. But of course, I paid $40 to see him.
Yeah.
And I imagine he gets quite a cut of that because there were still quite a few, several hundred people at the venue.
Yeah. Well, again, I mean, that's the music business is extremely lucrative. And the record business, we used to be the people who paid people. You know, I mean, I had a major artist tell me that who was a genius artist say that I said, how did you manage to put all those great records out in the 70s in such a short space of time? And one of the motivations was the starving artists, that we were the only people that paid him. So literally, they would put records out every 9 months because that's how they got the check. Because by the time they got to 9 months, they were broke. And to get more money, they needed to put a record out. And starvation is a great way, you know, to find art. I mean, you know, again, it goes back to a painter. A painter would sell his painting to eat.
No paintings, no Weetabix.
Exactly. No paintings, no Weetabix. Excellent analogy. But the fact is that that's what happened. And then we got less diligent about that process. And we ended up probably paying too much money and having the wrong principles for why some of the music was made. And then all of a sudden, with the advent of Napster and the decline of the CD and the question mark about whether downloads would replace CDs and whether that was the new business and digital was the new business, we suddenly became not the highest payers, because arena gigs became very sophisticated, stadium gigs became very sophisticated, festivals developed. When I was a kid growing up, as a late teenager, there was probably 4 festivals in Britain. There's probably 50 now, you know. And so the monetary value of an artist now is much more dramatic than it was 20 years ago. I mean, dramatically different. You know, but there were bands, I mean, some of the bands we talked about, you know, that would have, in that time, would have been a very different live business for them. And quite frankly, they'd have all made a lot more money. You know, I mean, you mentioned Deacon Blue. I mean, Deacon Blue were a very big band for us in the 80s. I mean, their arc would have been very different live-wise. But having said that, what Ricky did is he made a lot of records. And so actually, 30, 40 years later, he has a legacy and he has a catalogue, so he can still play because he made music. And one of the things I have to try and tell some of our artists is, please don't spend that long making moves that make you money on the road, that give you branding opportunities. Please, will you go back in the studio? Please make music. Because in 10 years' time, that's what will make the difference, a body of work. In 20 years' time, it will make even more difference, that body of work. So it's a balance. Because it is easy to get rich quicker now if you're an artist. Much easier.
And do you think, in a way, it's less about the music these days? I mean, I can remember, you know, back when it was the Scottish pop was in its ascendancy, Ricky Ross were, you know, had a bit of a reputation for being abrasive. Pat Kane of Hue and Cry turn a few people off because he was basically a bit of a bell end. You know, even though his music was great. Whereas nowadays, people are much more interested in Taylor Swift's Instagram, her lifestyle choices, even more, I would say, more so than ever. It's the product of the artist that, of which the music is just one part of it.
Well, I think
I'm just an old giffer now.
No. You are partly that, yeah, in the nicest possible way. I think that first of all, it's mature. So when I was growing up, you couldn't imagine your parents watching Starman by David Bowie on Top of the Pops and remotely understanding what it was. Now we all think we understand, so we watch whatever. Especially me, because I'm in the business, but I'm watching something with my kids who think something's exciting, you know, and we understand it. That wasn't the case, you know. So now music is much more the soundtrack of people's lives. The idea that music's less important, I don't agree with that. You know, music was important to generations before, but you know, but the chances of your parents liking the same thing as you was unheard of. So it was always segmented. Your parents liked, I don't know, my dad likes probably like swing music, and I don't mind it now.
My 11-year-old niece got me into Revolver recently. She's a massive Beatles fan, and I hadn't listened to it for 20 years. She's like, Uncle Paul, listen to Revolver. It's one of their best albums they've done.
And we need her in the music business. We need her in the record business. Those are the people we need in the record business that are listening to Revolver when they're 11 years old. God bless her. But you know, from the point of view, I think music's more important than ever. But it's a soundtrack, and it's a lifestyle, and everyone has musical taste. I mean, you know, it didn't. That wasn't the case when I was a kid growing up, and so it's and there is more money to be made, and there are a lot more people in the music business. You know, it's become, as I said, a much more organized business, and therefore there's more money. And if you're more organized, there's more money to be made, and it is an extremely lucrative business. I mean, you know, the live business. I mean, you can only explain the festivals, the growth of festivals. That you know, that's just an art based thing. That's to do with money. You know, and there are a ton of them, and presumably a lot of them fail because people are trying to raise the bar, but there's a ton of money. Branding has come into the business. There's a lot of money to be made from branding, you know, but I'm still a believer sometimes that less is more. And my job is to make sure the recorded output is significant so that when we sit here in 10 years time, we can be nostalgic about a body of work by an artist and not just one song and a brand association and 10 festival appearances.
Yeah, because although I bought Kung Fu Fighting on 7-inch, I've never listened to it since, whereas I still listen to the greatest hits of Spandau Ballet.
Yeah, no. Well, I mean,
so
I think
the better the work is, the more likely the repeat plays.
Yes, exactly. And that's, you know, I mean with the greatest with the Carl Douglas, and I'm sure Carl's done great, and I'm sure he's a good chap. He's not able to headline Wembley Arena in 2018.
He'll be one of these people where I'm not sure whether he's dead or not. I mean, he could well still be alive.
We've got so much to Google after this, haven't we? If anybody's listened to this podcast, then luckily they can Google as we go along.
Exactly.
And they can see. I mean, I think, I don't know if he's, I mean, he was American, Carl Douglas.
I just remember he was on top of the pops.
He had the outfit on top of the pops.
He did literally have the outfit.
Yeah, and the producer was in the was one of the backing vocalists. And the producer did very well. That was the guy who did other stuff like the Bidu Orchestra and Tina Charles, and so he was. Wow. But he did backing vocals. So on that. So no, it was a production house record.
But, now, I know that you know you have a glamorous life. You're traveling all around the world, and you're friends with Bruce Springsteen and all that gubbins, right? Yeah, I accept that. What are the stresses of the job? Because if I was in your shoes, the thing that might bankrupt the company 8 years from now is almost unforeseeable right now.
Yes,
so you've almost got to try and you know have the Donald Rumsfeld style unknown unknowns. You've got to be a forecaster and see things and have insights that other people haven't yet seen. Is that existentially stressful?
Yes. And I think that there is never a minute of the day when you're not trying to think of what might happen next. And there is never enough hours in the day to listen to music you have to listen to. And there is always, which is the most exciting thing about doing what I do, is there's always the opportunity that you may listen to something that may change the destiny of the company. You know, you may hear a piece of music or hear an artist or make that extra effort to go somewhere. Or someone says to me, you should get on the plane and see this artist because this is really special. And I may be going, well, that's real annoying because tomorrow night I said I'd go to the cinema with my family or I was going to do something, you know, relatively normal. And then you go, and you're on that plane and you're going to go and see whatever it was that someone recommended. And I spend my life frequently in that dilemma. My children laugh at me because basically I'm conflicted about sometimes two choices. And, you know, for instance, if I have three shows in New York on a night, I will try and go to three shows if I can, you know, because I want to make sure I'm not missing out on something that might be relevant, you know. So, yes, it's always there. It's unending. It's a bit of a quest without sounding like too Indiana Jones about it. There is a quest there. You're always hoping to find something that becomes something magical.
And does it work the other way, where an amazing opportunity might present itself and you're the guy that turns the Beatles down and says no one's interested in guitar-based music anymore?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, we've all done it. I mean, there's not a person in my position who hasn't made a mistake. Or it's not even a mistake. Sometimes you don't be the right person. I mean, I went to Bath Moles twice in a month. Once I saw the Manic Street Preachers and I did sign them. And then I saw a band called On a Friday and I didn't sign them. And that band turned out to be Radiohead. And obviously I love Radiohead and I've seen Radiohead many times since. I may not have been the right person to work with Radiohead anyway, but the fact is I saw them both in a month and I decided to sign one and I didn't sign the other. You know, it turned out okay, turned pretty good because the Manics are great, but I'd have wished I'd done them both.
Yeah, because from a commercial sense that someone else is getting Radiohead's royalties.
Someone else is getting Radiohead's royalties, that's right. But my judgment, first of all, is based on, you know, how much I love the group. And in that stage, especially when I was late 20s, it was like, you know, it, It was a bit more subjective, really, than objective. I'm a bit more objective now.
I might be glamorising it here, but do you have like a network of spotters? You know, like, 'cause, I mean, I used to listen to new music with John Peel and Matt Goodyear with the Evening Session on Radio 1. But do you have like really long-haired early 20-year-olds in New York that go to like dingy clubs and that they're the guys who can make the call? How do you actually... You can't go to every gig, so who tells you what gigs to go to?
We have a huge network. Huge, and now with the internet, we have a research network. So we have kids, all of whom like music, who come out of college and they research the internet, and they're all massive music fans, and they're tech savvy, and they all research as much information. And you know, my adage to them is, I say, listen, if you find something that has data that's unusual, that's great, but preferably, we're not standing there at the back of their show in a rainy night in February and they're terrible and they just had that one song. And so ideally, you're finding something that's special as well. But you know, we have a tremendous, obviously, I mean, we're a big company, a global company. We have a tremendous network of talent scouts and consultants and A&R staff that's tiered in experience terms. So, yeah, we have a pretty wide net.
How do you divide your time, if you don't mind asking? I mean, what's a typical week for you? And you're not allowed to say there's no typical week, because we all know that. But pretend there was. Where would you be? What would you do?
Well, my typical week would be ideally if I was at least 3 days in the office. I mean, I tend to go on a triangle between London, New York, and Los Angeles, and if I'm in New York, probably 65 to 70% of the time, then I'm going to be either in Los Angeles or London, occasionally in Europe. Sometimes, because I work for a Japanese company, I'm in Tokyo 3 times a year. If I can try and get to Australia once a year, I will. But mostly New York if I can, because that's where my office is based. But obviously, my background and my heart is in England, and so I am in Britain a lot. And you know, there's always something to be done. But probably, yeah. I mean, it sounds sort of glamorous to be running around, but you know, it's not as glamorous as it appears. You know, it's still waking up at strange hours and not knowing where you are, and then realizing you get off a plane at 9 o'clock in the morning and go straight to work, and then get back on a plane at 9 o'clock that evening. You know, I don't expect anybody to feel sorry for me. You know, I'm very grateful and very happy every single day for what I do. But you know, it's not always a bundle of laughs and rock and roll decadence. It's not always like that.
Do you still get excited to work with artists, though? Not in a kind of starstruck sense. I mean, I worked in Parliament for many years, and you know, when you see the Foreign Secretary queuing up for coffee in front of you, you nearly want to go up to them and say, excuse me, you're the Foreign Secretary. Yeah. But within a couple of weeks, it actually becomes pretty normal, and then you end up focusing on the negatives, like, I mean, you know, why is Parliament so cold, and why doesn't it have useful Wi-Fi, and all of these kind of things. But, you know, when you meet someone like Bruce Springsteen, do you still excited to meet someone like that?
Of course, actually, I took Shakira to Parliament once, and it was actually really good fun because Shakira wanted to see the workings of Parliament. And when they found out she was there, I mean, they were very nice, but then Gordon Brown met her, and then when Tony Blair wanted to meet her too, so, you know, of course, everyone wanted to meet Shakira.
Were you with Alan Edwards that night? I think he's told the same anecdote on this podcast.
I can't remember who organised for us to get into Parliament, but it was great. It was funny because actually, you know, because she has I think she had something to do with the United Nations, so and Gordon Brown did as well, but then Tony Blair was there quick as well to meet her.
So I bet he was.
Yeah, so.
Because that's the thing, you've got the star power there, haven't you? They're the ones that want to meet who you're with rather than the other way around.
I'm super reverential about, you know, you know, look, when you, I have a good relationship with a lot of the iconic artists on the label, but I'm also very cognizant that I'm talking to iconic artists, you know, it's like, and I'm very respectful and very transparent and I'm aware of that aura. You have to be aware of that aura. I mean, it's like if you're in a room with David Bowie, he was, God bless him, one of the most fantastic company and friendly and chatty. But you are aware, and he's aware you're aware too. You know, you don't get to be like that without that. But having said that, you know, some of the artists of that scale are tremendous company and are a joy to be with, you know.
And some of them aren't.
Some of them, no, I mean, I don't see it like that. I mean, I may have seen like that 25 years ago when I was full of, you know, vinegar coming up the business, but I don't see it like that now. I mean, they're entitled to be how the hell they want to be. You know, it's like the most important thing is, as I've said before, to have delivered a catalogue of work that makes people think and that makes people excited and makes people challenge and nostalgic and all those kind of things. And I don't, they don't owe me anything. You know,
is it a generational thing? I mean, we've a friend of mine, Lawrence Atkinson, is a big Hollywood PR guy. He's actually done this podcast, and he works with the likes of Dustin Hoffman, Harrison Ford, you know, people like that, Robert Redford. And he says that they're absolute gentlemen. They're a joy to be around, very respectful, very reverential, great company. But he says when he works with people who are off of TOWIE and things like that, you know, that they're, you know, they've got a small glimmer of him, that they tend to be impossible and have huge riders and blah, blah, blah.
Fame is incredibly enticing. And, you know, music artists get to be famous. It's incredibly alluring, and it can be very, very nasty, you know, and it's hard. You know, you have someone who suddenly, you know, has, I mean, I think it's the same with footballers now as well. You suddenly have a lot of money in your bank account, and everybody's telling you great. That is bound to get you. When we were talking before the podcast about what would have been like to have that money when you're in your 20s and all that, I don't know how I would have dealt with it if I was 20 years old and everybody was telling me I was great all day and that I had, you know, that I was immortal.
It must send you doolally.
It does, and I think it does. And I've worked with a lot of people, it does, you know, and you know.
And then to have, you know, it taken off you as well.
And then you have it taken off you, and then you spend the rest of your life telling stories about why it was taken off you.
I went to see Beverly Craven. I don't know if you remember.
She was signed
her.
To us, yeah.
She performed at Milton Keynes Stables about 6 months ago. And of course, she did Promise Me and all the songs. And she, to be honest, she was absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
The guy in the car park who was the steward who showed us in was Jeffrey from Rainbow. Do you remember that TV show?
And I'd. Bungo and Zippy.
The human guy, though.
Jeffrey was famous.
The guy who helped me, showed me where the car parking space was. And, like, that, to me, just showed both sides of fame, really. Is that, you know, he was there, he was presenting the main kids show, and suddenly he was doing
that. It'd be even weirder if you'd been to see Rainbow and Beverly Craven was the car park attendant. That'd have been really strange, wouldn't it?
Someone must come up to him and say,
with Beverly Craven as the car park attendant, that'd have been really strange. And then he said, yeah. So I was just driving to see Zippy and Bungle and Jeffrey at Rainbow, and Beverly Craven was there. Well, I mean, he's on quite a lot of Where Are They Now type features and everything. And I guess he must be in his 70s now, probably late 60s, 70s. But yeah, I mean, it's tough, and I've seen it. And by the way, I've actually said, this is going to go wrong. Please don't behave like this. This isn't going to end well. And you really, really have to get yourself together. And some of them have come back. Some of these artists who come back to me 5 years later or 10 years later and said, it was a pretty rocky ride that. And I said, I know. I'm really sorry that it didn't all pan out and everything. And they said, oh, no, we understand now. You know, it's like. And so, you know, yes, it's. I mean, I honestly think that's show business. It's obviously not music, it's film, it's now sport as well, and you know, it's very difficult. I watched the George Best documentary that was put out recently. I mean, you know, that was tragic. I mean, but having said that, you know, he had a bright flame that burned very quickly. You know?
Or as my nieces would say, Callum Best's dad.
Callum Best's dad. Is that the same? That's not the same niece who listened to Revolver, is it? Is that the same one? Callum.
Unforgivable.
Yeah, unforgivable, right. Yeah.
So, penultimate question then. You mentioned that Bowie was great to work with. I'm not expecting you to kind of dish any dirt on anyone that you didn't enjoy working with, but who's been the best people you've worked with so far? Who's been a joy to work with?
Oh, I mean, you know, look, I love work. I mean, the Manic Street Preachers, I mean, for whatever reason, we went through a lot together, you know, with the disappearance of Richie and then really breaking through properly on the fourth record. So that was amazing. And you know, I speak to them a lot, and we're friends with our families and our kids, and, you know, and it, that's, I'm 27 years in, and I love them as human beings, and the level of loyalty and thoughtfulness that we have to each other is pretty remarkable for this business. You know, I mean, I've worked with Adele now for 9 years. I think she's incredibly special. I understand all the challenges, you know. I mean, honestly, Beyonce is very special. I mean, most of the artists that I work with, I honestly, especially the ones who've been around a lot, I don't really have a bad word to say about them. I understand what they go through. I have unique insight into the difficulties they encounter, and I have enormous respect. So, you know, I don't have a bad word to say about most of our important artists. You know, going back to your one hit wonders thing, we've had a few one hit wonders where you've gone, honestly, this is just too much pain to do this. But the fact is that most of them, you know, I've had special times with. I mean, there's artists that I haven't seen frequently, but when I've met them, it's been great. And I've been like a fan, and I've been like, you know, I've I've done incredible things with artists that people who have other jobs that are lucrative, I don't know, working for, you know, investment bank, and that I've done things that people would pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to do that are part of my job. And I'm really honestly grateful for that every single day. It never leaves me. There are things where I go, isn't this mad that I'm doing this? And I'm actually getting paid for it, which is really weird. But I'm doing this, and this is a moment. And hopefully when I'm sitting with the tartan rug, living in the English countryside, when I move back from America eventually, those moments will be everything that I remember. That will be the bit. It won't be a disc on the wall. It will be. Wasn't that great when we sat and did this?
And that preempts my final question. What has been the best moment of your career so far, and what's been the worst?
The best moment, honestly, is when you hear those records and you're in a studio or someone comes in to play you something. You hear that record and you go, that is great. That is going to be a huge hit, and that is going to change everything. And those are the best moments. And I can remember those moments so vividly. And that's still really the criteria by which I get up in the morning, really. So, you know, that's it. And the worst, the worst moments,
This podcast.
Yeah, the worst moment was in the last 45 minutes. Now, the worst moment is when, you know, when you can see things going wrong. And you're trying to help fix it and you can't. And you know it's not going to work. And you're trying to limit the damage. You know something isn't going to be successful. And even though you're going through the motions to try and make something okay, it doesn't turn out to be okay. And again, that's something that could happen to me next week. And the varied, the size of the roster I work with and the varied artists I work with, it's a constant dilemma as to whether something's going to be incredible and work beautifully or something's going to fail. It's a pretty complicated failure success strike rate. So I face those challenges most days, really. But
Rob, this could be a 3-hour podcast. It's been that interesting, but we've run out of metaphorical tape, so we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you ever so much.
Pleasure. We'll do one-hit wonders some other time. We'll start. You just have to reel off a load of one-hit wonders, and I'll answer you back.
Well, you'd have to do it as well. We'd have to co-present it. I'm not going to take all the presenting duties.
We may have come up with something there. Okay.
Thanks again.
Cheers.
A Right Angles podcast in association with Big Things Media.